Off the Ball, GAA.
But the reason we carry a smaller panel is because some players can't live to those standards and cultures that we're trying to achieve.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Hello, Owen here, and welcome to Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball. In every episode of this series, we're going to be going to a different country in Latin America. And very shortly, we'll be going to Colombia. We'll be playing the national sport, which involves the consumption of beer and the explosion of packages. We'll be going to Medellin to talk football and Pablo Escobar. We'll be talking about why Colombian farmers love cycling so much, and a lot more. Before that though, at the start of every episode, there's going to be a short diary entry from a hitchhiking journey through Argentinian Patagonia. This hitchhiking story will continue at the beginning of every episode. So this is just a heads up that episodes will generally exist on two separate timelines. Now, I'll put all of our information in the show notes, but if you like what you hear, I would be extremely grateful for positive ratings, reviews, and also a generous sense of forgiveness towards my level of Spanish. Cheers.
I'm thinking of hitchhiking to Ushuaia. You know hitchhiking?
Ah, yes.
Is it? It's an okay country for hitchhiking?
Yes, do it, man. Yes. The past I traveled doing hiking.
Yeah.
But no more. The truck don't stop.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
Nobody stopped. Yeah. In the past, yes, I traveled a lot doing that, but now, not now. Nobody stopped.
Okay.
Bolsillo delantera. Si tenés algo para tirar, acércalo a la tripulación al bajar del avión. Te recordamos que está prohibido fumar hasta salir del aeropuerto.
No autobus, no?
For some reason, I've decided to hitchhike through Argentina. I'm in a town called San Carlos de Bariloche. It's in the north of Patagonia, and I need to make it all the way south to Ushuaia for a flight that I've got booked in a couple of weeks. The journey I'm hoping to go on is going to see me hitchhike 2,500 kilometres. That's about the same distance as driving from London to Kiev. The problem, though, is that it immediately seems that I'm not very good at this.
Me? Tu nombre? Owen.
Owen?
Sí.
Owen.
Muchas gracias, Sebastian.
Sebastian here has pulled in to help drive me to the outskirts of Bariloche. But Sebastian, it turns out, is a taxi driver. In case you weren't aware, having to pay for lifts is not how hitchhiking is supposed to work.
Y hasta luego.
Hasta luego. Buen viaje.
Muchas gracias, amigo.
Welcome to Ruta 40, or Route 40. This is the main artery that runs north to south in Argentina. This is going to be my home for the next couple of weeks, a place that will slowly get more unforgiving and more annoying the further south I go.
I haven't actually hitchhiked before, but I presume it's easy.
Narrator, it would not be easy.
I'm hoping that this is going to be, you know, smooth sailing.
Narrator, it would not be smooth sailing. After an hour of standing on the side of Route 40, my pride has taken a hell of a battering. Embarrassment is no longer a mere threat. It is the reality. Now, given I am very Irish and very ginger, the main threat I have to deal with is that of sunburn.
It's only 11:30 and I can feel my skin peeling off inch by inch as I get flayed by this hitchhiking experience. But other than that, it's been great.
Sometimes a car or a truck will come along and slow down, and my heart leaps out of my chest, thinking that this could be the moment. But every single time, they're just turning into the shop across the road, or slowing to merely stare at me, to stare at the weirdo with his thumb out on the side of the road. And every time this happens, I look a little bit like Roy Hodgson in that clip of him, the one where he's watching a game as England manager. If you haven't seen this clip, Hodgson and his eyes are alive with hope. His team are attacking and they're threatening. but his face immediately turns to despondence in the blink of a second as his terrible team lets him down in attack once again. You can see it in his face that he knew he never should have had hope. Today, right now, I am Roy Hodgson. The clock ticks away towards midday, and I've been here for 2 hours now. I'm starting to think that maybe I was wrong all along. Maybe I am quite a threatening looking guy. But a white Toyota comes flying down the road, and for once, the driver looks at me and does not see a murderer. Comes to a halt. This is actually happening.
No hablo inglés.
Sí,
no.
This is Mikhail from Buenos Aires, my lord and savior for the day.
Nice.
Vos?
Irlanda. Sí.
Holanda?
Irlanda. Sí.
This is Argentina, so inevitably our conversation turns to football pretty quickly.
¿Te gusta el fútbol?
Oh, mucho.
A mí también.
¿Y qué es tu equipo?
Yo soy de Vélez.
For someone to say that they support a team not called Boca or River piques my interest, and Mikhail is a Vélez Sarsfield fanatic.
Vélez, champion war in 1994.
He wasn't even born for this, but he's regaling me with tales of how they conquered the world in 1994, when they beat that great AC Milan team, managed by Fabio Capello, in the Intercontinental Cup. For two full hours, Mikhail tolerates my broken Spanish, probably regretting ever slowing down when he saw me. But we go all the way to El Bolsón. It's a little bit of a hippie town, about 120 kilometers south of Bariloche. I call it quits for the day when we get there. In the grand scheme of things, this is a tiny distance for a full day of hitchhiking. I do only have 2 weeks to get to Ushuaia. But my thinking is that the first day is always the hardest, that tomorrow would surely be easier. Narrator, that thinking would be completely incorrect. Two months earlier.
Mbappe steps up first. And Mbappe rattles it in.
When I arrived in Latin America in late 2022, there was only one thing that I really wanted to do.
Messi with such immaculate poise.
It was, of course, a World Cup year. It was a golden opportunity.
Coleman. Great stop. Martinez is punching the air again.
I was going to go to Argentina.
Dybala down the middle.
I was going to Rosario, Messi's hometown, his last World Cup, and watch one of their games in his hometown.
Tchouaméni has dragged it wide! And Argentina are on the cusp!
I was going to Buenos Aires, and I was going to be in the thick of one of the most feverish populations in the world. If they happened to win the World Cup, I would be in the middle of what would probably be the biggest party in the history of the human race.
A long, lonely walk for Gonzalo Montiel. Didn't start the game, he could finish it.
And win the World Cup, they did.
Montiel. Argentina, champions of the world! Scaloni will be fated. Messi will be sainted.
Montiel!
But I wasn't there. Nope, I did not go to Argentina for the World Cup. I literally had one job and I bottled it. I don't know when exactly I bottled it. It was probably around the time when I realised that Latin America, believe it or not, is a lot bigger in reality than it is on a map. Now this stunning revelation took me completely off guard. And when the World Cup final was kicking off, I came to my senses, looked around, and was like, oh shit, I'm in Colombia. So every time I saw another video coming from Buenos Aires and people almost dying as they were celebrating the World Cup, I got more and more jealous. I started to realise that the FOMO I was experiencing was probably the worst FOMO anybody has ever experienced in the history of FOMO. Imagine the worst fear you've ever had, except it's permanent. When the Argentina goalkeeper Emiliano Martinez received his Golden Glove Award, he proceeded to turn his trophy into this phallus-like symbol and he thrust it at the public. When he did this, it sort of felt like he may as well have been thrusting this resplendent golden knob directly at me. I could imagine him saying to me, "What an idiot you are. You had one job." My name is Owen Chahan, and over the course of this series, I'm travelling from the United States all the way to the very bottom of South America. I'm going to be meeting people who love sport and who love other things as well. There's going to be stories of hitchhiking, of ritualistic fighting festivals, of football, food, and the fear. The fear that comes with bottling the chance to be at the greatest party in the history of the universe.
Medellín está escuchando Me.
Welcome to Medellín, objectively one of the greatest cities in the world. It's a city famous for Comuna 13, for Fernando Botero, and its metro system. The people in the city are known as paisas, and the metro is one of the things that paisas are most proud of. It's clean, effective, and most importantly, Bogota does not have one. And I get their pride, because as an Irish person, I'm a sucker for any sort of public transport system that actually works. And if I can offer one word of life advice, it is to find someone who looks at you like a paisa looks at their metro.
Medellin is incredible. Medellin is the best place I've ever been.
Simon Edwards is a football writer and agent based in Medellin.
It's beautiful. The people are incredibly warm and friendly. People here are remarkable. Like, if you're walking down the street and a tiny corner of a 2,000 peso note is hanging out of your pocket, within 10 seconds someone will tap you on the shoulder and say, "Hey, be careful," you know, because they don't want you to have a bad experience.
Right now it's January, so in senior men's football terms, it's pre-season. But there is some action to be found. Sure enough, there is a gang of Independiente Medellin fans out in force. Again, it's pre-season, so we're not actually watching the Independiente Medellin play. No, we're watching Medellin's under-13s team play. This is what's known as baby football. It's a phenomenally popular tournament for kids that takes place in Medellin every January.
This is like an under-13s tournament, and every Colombian national team player you can name will have played in this tournament. Quintero was a standout player, James won it and was named player of the tournament, Falcao, Guarín, take your pick. And there's thousands of fans. The stadium is full, fans with drums and bands, and it's the moment when a lot of these young players are kind of first appear on the radars of clubs. The atmosphere in these games is amazing, huge crowds, as I say, and that continues again at youth level. So Colombia really, really buys into this youth football. And also, I think that attitude of not just, you know, professional men's football kind of being so important is also a reason the women's football took off so quickly in Colombia. The first ever final of the Colombian Women's League had 40,000 fans in attendance in Bogota. So it's been really interesting to see how people have embraced that.
Every day you've got wall-to-wall matches going on. During the peak heat hours in the daytime, you've got old lads using the bleachers for their siestas. While at nighttime it comes alive with locals packing the benches to horse down aguardiente and sing the club songs. Now, I realise that this is the first time I've mentioned aguardiente on this podcast, and I think it's important that we pause for a moment to pay due respect to this centrepiece of Colombian culture. Now, aguardiente is a clear liquor between 25 and 30% alcohol. You buy a bottle, you sit outside, and you proceed to do shots until said bottle is empty.
llanera soledad.
It comes in three variations. You've got a red cap one, a blue cap one, and one with a green cap.
It's the cheap alcohol, right? So, you know, you got to be friendly. You got to, you know, bring everyone in. So first of all, blue top, not red top.
Okay.
Because that's no sugar. Okay. And the sugar's really not bringing anything to the table, like in the aguardiente. It's okay. Probably making it taste slightly worse. And you don't want the extra sugar for the hangover.
So science.
Yeah. Go blue. Go blue top.
Alegría.
And in terms of the taste, look, if it's hot, it's horrible. But if it's chilled, it's all right. It's all right. Smooth action. Don't get it hit the throat too bad, and then you're going down.
By the time you leave Colombia, you might still have some blood left in your aguardiente system.
It's like Sambuca without that sweetness, right?
Yeah.
So it's pretty bland. Don't throw it back too fast, and yeah, it's all right. It's okay. It's not too bad.
I can confirm that Sambuca is not fit to lace aguardiente's shoes. If Jesus could go back in time and turn the water at the wedding of Cana into aguardiente instead of wine, I'm absolutely sure he would.
So much of what we want to do can seem impossible, but the highest achievers among us are the people still reaching for something. The ones who aren't satisfied to stay where they are and want to keep climbing higher. It's those people who approach the impossible and embrace it. There's a vehicle for people like that. It's called the Defender. The Defender is an icon reimagined through thoroughly modern design. It's got a tough, rigid body design and durable, lightweight monocoque architecture for extra strength. With precise detailing and compelling proportions, the exterior of the Defender is designed with integrity. This is a vehicle capable of great things, engineered to meet challenges head-on with an exterior that's been tested to the extreme. Experience the Defender's legendary capability off-road and on. And there's a family of vehicles for Defender. Meet the Defender 90, Defender 110, and the 8-seat Defender 130. So, are you ready to embrace the impossible? Explore the Defender at LandRoverUSA.com.
Medellin is known as the city of the eternal spring, which means temperatures hit the high 20s pretty much 365 days a year. The disparity in the amount of rain is significant, though. Thankfully, it's January, and it's the driest month of the year. At least that's what I read on Wikipedia. Tonight, Atletico Nacional of Medellin face Alianza Lima of Peru. It's a friendly, so it's probably fair to say that we can't expect too much of an occasion. Or not. Green and white everywhere around the Atanasio Girardot Stadium, and you would be forgiven for thinking that it's derby night. What makes this even crazier is that no one actually believes the game is happening, and it eventually does get called off. These fans have basically showed up to stand outside their stadium in biblical rain for a friendly match that was never happening.
Nacional is the king of the cups. So Nacional is a team who has national support, as the name would suggest. They're a team of Colombia, of the country, and they represent kind of Antioquia and national, you know, pride in the region.
Nacional are the most decorated club in Colombian football, and the only club from the country to have won the Copa Libertadores, which is the South American Champions League, twice. Their first win came in 1989. And in the final that year against Olimpia of Paraguay, it went to penalties.
Andres Escobar arranca, tiro!
That's Andres Escobar scoring his penalty. The same Andres Escobar who was murdered in Medellin after scoring an own goal at the 1994 World Cup.
Lo tapó Reneguita! Lo tapó Reneguita! Lo tapó René!
The other most recognisable name from this team is the goalkeeper René Higuita, who made multiple saves to tee up Leonel Alvarez for the winning penalty.
Colombia campeón de América. Colombia campeón continental, Colombia campeón continental, mi patria querida, Colombia campeón continental. Lionel no podía fallar, Lionel le pegó con el alma y se hizo la valla de Paraguay. Colombia campeón continental, hermoso el toque de penal de Lionel, la pelota grandiosa entra en el barco paraguayo. Colombia campeón continental.
Nope, those are not my slick editing skills that you're listening to. The Colombian national anthem is played on the television coverage as the commentator is going ballistic. The first time a Colombian team wins the Libertadores is obviously going to be an understandably patriotic moment. But the elephant in the room here is that Pablo Escobar effectively owned this team and funded their success. Now, I'm not here to do a full podcast on narco football. It is a subject that has been covered to the nth degree over the past couple of decades, and the people here in Medellin are understandably pissed off when a foreigner comes in, having just watched Narcos, and wants to talk about Escobar all day. But I do have one question, and that surrounds the legacy of that 1989 Libertadores win. I'm wondering how much that's been tainted today, so I called up Dr. Pete Watson of the University of Leeds to ask him. This guy is an encyclopedia on South American football.
It was a very Colombian triumph. It was achieved with Colombian players who had come up through the ranks from Medellin, a lot of them, to achieve that. Unfortunately, though, you know, there are a lot of stories about particularly the semi-finals and the final about whether drug threats were involved. There is a story in the Danubio game. Danubio are a team from Uruguay. The first leg had ended 0-0 in Montevideo, so Danubio travelled to Medellin. But the referees say that on the night before the game, someone came into their room, or a few people came into their hotel room, threatening them. Apparently, it was Popeye Juan Jairo Velasquez, one of Pablo Escobar's most infamous kind of lieutenants. And they offered them money to throw the game. They had guns. They threatened them with their lives. All three of them have said in interviews that they didn't take the money, but were very worried. As it turns out, Nacional won the game 6-0, which immediately looked suspicious. Danubio certainly didn't play very well. They didn't seem to be at their best, let's say. And again, but it is a very national moment. You're absolutely right. The national anthem comes on, the flag comes on it. It's not Vamos Medellin, it's Vamos Colombia. So yeah, it was a very national moment, but it is always going to be tainted in some way. But I think that one of the best things Nacional have done since was after the horrific Chapecoense plane crash a few years ago, I think it was 2016, a Brazilian team was pretty much wiped out as they crashed before a game against Nacional. It was going to be one of the finals. And again, Nacional end up conceding that final. They say, no, we can't win on these circumstances. The cup is yours. And I think Nacional will win some kind of FIFA Fair Play Award for that particular year. So there is an attempt to get away from those times. But again, I think that it's like one of the problems is with Colombian football is that everyone knows the narco stories. The narco stories always go back to Pablo Escobar. That always goes back to Medellin. And it tends to go back to Nacional, although some people have said that he was actually more of a fan of Deportivo Independiente Medellin.
How are you doing, David? See you.
Speaking of Deportivo Independiente Medellin, I'm at their club store. This is a club that's got fewer trophies than their rivals Atlético Nacional, but it's billed as the People's Club, and it's seen as a sort of anti-establishment. I'm here to meet one of the ultras from Resistencia Norte, which is the name of one of the Barras Bravas connected to the team.
In English.
His name is David Ortega.
¿Cuántas preguntas son?
He wants to know how many questions I have. There are some other ultras in the shop, and they do look a small bit intimidating, although being Irish seems to help.
Irlanda.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
Oye, ¿sabes español?
Ah, un poquito.
That being said, for all I know, this particular ultra here might be telling me he's going to kick the shit out of me once I've done my interview.
Medellin is like a team that's been related with the life of the poor people, you know. We are called paisas. You have to be a hard person, you know, because the geography of Antioquia is very difficult, you know, the mountains. It's hard, so the people of Antioquia has a special kind of of thinking about life. You know, they're like warriors, not in the war term, you know, like violence. So, but being like people that in life are always strong, no matter what. I think since I was in the belly of my mom, I'm coming to the stadium all my life. And when I was like 13, 1998, begins Resistencia Norte. Medellin is like our life, man, you know. Medellin is everything we do.
Barras Bravas are often referred to as the South American version of hooligans, but there has been an interesting social movement in recent years known as the Barrismo Social.
So Barrismo Social is like thinking about not only the sport and the moment that we are in the stadium and we're singing and we're playing, so thinking that this is something that's related with being part of a city, you know, part of a community, trying to help and sometimes, you know, where there's a disaster and when Christmas, trying to give something to the kids that don't have the opportunity to have some gift. And Resistencia Norte is a group that is integrated by people of all of parts of society, you know, like we have people that are rich in what we can talk in Colombia, rich, and we have people that lives in the street, you know.
By the time I finally had the opportunity to have this chat with David and the rest of the Barra Brava, the season has started. Santa Fe of Bogota are in town, with former Wigan star Hugo Rodallega on the bench. I fire on any red or blue clothes that I've got and I squeeze into the north stand at Atanasio Girardot. David and the rest of Resistencia Norte are set up there for every home game.
Medellin is a way of living, man, you know. I don't imagine my life without Medellin. I won't be me if Medellin wouldn't exist.
Santa Fe have a man sent off after 6 minutes, but proceed to take the lead 15 minutes later. But in South America, the fans don't stop singing.
We are a group of crazy people like us. We are friends, you know. We are the people that live this way because they are fans and they are fans, you know. I think that we are the toppest of the toppest, you know. Going to a Medellin match, it's like a... To me, it was an epiphany, you know. I began going to see Medellin since I was a kid. I won't stop never, you know. To the day I am dead, you know, I'm going to be in the stadium and in every city, you know, where I can go.
In the second half, Medellin do get their equaliser. By the way, in case you're interested, the menu at halftime involves arepas and pork.
You had to play soccer like it was like a life and death issue, you know. Always. That's Medellin. We are proud. We are proud people, you know. Los paisas, we are proud. But not in the bad way. If you want to die, you have to die, stand up, you know. You're never going to die on your knees.
The pressure is piled on deep into the second half. And eventually, Medellin get a penalty in the 92nd minute. But VAR, that eternal killjoy, overturns the decision. And I don't get to experience the euphoria of an injury time winner here.
We have identity, you know. Colombia, you can tell, I can tell you, Colombia is like six or seven kind of culture, or cultures, you know. And the paisa culture is one of those. And we are different people, you know, not because we're better now. No, you know, shit and good things, there are in all the cities and all the world, you know. There are good people here in Somalia and Ireland and everywhere in the world. There are good and bad people, you know. Everybody's proud of this, of the part they live, you know. You can born in a shithole, you're gonna say that it's the better place of the world, you know. But Medellin maybe has something special, you know. The people, the way of being, you know. The way you make feel the people that is not from Medellin. That you come to Medellin and you feel like you know this place and the people is good, you know. And thinking that maybe you thought of people in Europe and another part of the things like Colombia, it's a crazy thing, you know. So this is the life, you know, knowing people, talking with people. That you are the same guy that me, you know. The difference that you talk English, I talk Spanish. Maybe things that are not important, you know, like the shit that I think that is good in life is like recognize that we are human, you know, like we're part of the same place, and that's life, knowing and living and traveling.
Esta sí es la hinchada bella, es el equipo que amamos, hace 30 años ganamos, ahí nuestra primera estrella, este año celebraremos, buscaremos la tercera, con un fútbol de primera, a todos les ganaremos.
Any national sport that gives you the opportunity to blow stuff up is a good national sport, in my books.
Vamos, Teo!
This is Tejo.
Yeah, I'm local!
Oh, boy, that guy is local.
Everybody get to where you can see.
And this is Chris Kajolas.
Short people in the front.
I'm originally from Bradenton, Florida. I moved to Brazil 13 years ago to be with a girl. Never moved to a foreign country to be with a girl, just FYI. So anyway, when that didn't work out, I wound up in Colombia. About 7 years ago, I found Tejo. Nice. And thought, man, tourists would love to play this. And so I started playing just to get good at it. Boom, explosion behind me. I'm the only gringo that competes in the sport in the world. And I play in the professional league of Tejo for Colombia.
So what we're going to do, I'm going to explain to you the rules. I'm going to take you back to the middle, show you how to throw. And then while you're playing, I'm going to coach you.
You have a metal disc, and you throw it into the pit of clay. So whatever team lands closest to the metal ring, it's called a bocine. Whoever lands closest to the bocine, the team gets 1 point, and 1 point only, no matter who's closest, or how many people are close. If you hit the little powder of explosives, you get 3 points. If you throw it and land it in the middle of the circle, you get 6 points. And if you throw it and land it in the middle of the circle with an explosion, you get 9 points.
It's a pretty amazing feeling when you get that first instance of boom.
He got it. He got it. He did great.
I was the worst Tejo player of all time, right up until Chris was like, hey, just pretend you're showing me your car keys.
You're looking at me. Put it in my hand. Throw me car keys.
I've been doing this for 7 years, so I've had to come up with different ways of teaching. So I'm glad that worked for you.
All right, so Tejo, like I said in the beginning, this is the national sport of Colombia. This game predates the Spaniards' arrival to Colombia. So this game is over 500 years old. The original name of the game is Turmeque, for the Turmeque Indians that created the game. So how you played Turmeque 500 years ago? They did not have steel, and they did not have paper and explosives in Colombia. So the disc was made of solid gold. The triangle was also made of solid gold. So in the tribe, if you threw your golden disc and hit the golden triangle, you got to keep the gold as your prize. And we could still do that, it's just a lot more money.
Nowadays, what you do is you throw a metal disc, and behind us, there are packages of there are packages of explosives. So when you throw your Tejo, if you hit the powder and the ring behind it, it'll blow up.
The perfect Tejo shot is one of the most satisfying feelings in world sport for terrible sports people like me. Also, a crucial component of this game, which cannot be neglected, is the fact that drinking beer is pretty much mandatory. When the bottles of Aguila start flowing, everyone feels like an absolute superstar.
Unfortunately, with Tejo, there's a reputation to the game, and people tend to think of it as either a poor person's game or a drunk person's game. For me, it's a dying sport.
Okay.
It's old guys, you know, like me, that are mostly playing. When you go out to the league tournaments, you know, there are younger people that play, but, you know, I don't know if there's enough of them to maintain a growth level. Okay. Now, they are trying to revitalize it by hopefully making it an Olympic sport. There is a push for that, but I've met the head of the Olympic Committee for Colombia, and I don't get the feeling he gives a crap about, you know, this.
That's it, everybody. Pay your bar tabs, and thank you very much.
One final question, Chris. Am I going to make it as a professional Tejo player?
I think if you get another explosion, I think you'll be right there.
Nice. Well, we'll see you out there on the court, Chris. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries, man. See
Cheers.
You in a bit.
Believe it or not, Chris was merely tickling my belly. Tejo is particularly big in Salento. It's around 6 hours south of Medellin. And not only are the local guys who are playing in the hall here around 10 times better than me, they're also throwing the disc from double the range. Once I see them in action, I know it's time to park my dream of moving to rural Colombia and becoming a professional Tejo player. The scenic route to get to Salento is a white-knuckle ride, and I discovered this when I hopped on a bus from the town of Jardín. A poor quality service combined with frequent downpours means you've got less of a road and more of a swamp. Predictably, when we get to the swamp, the bus that I'm on drops a gear, drops another gear, before there are no more gears, and we come to a stop. We are stuck. This is not the driver's first rodeo, though. He's prepared. First, on go a pair of yellow wellies. Second, he produces a shovel. If the road doesn't exist, he's going to dig us a road. It's unclear what the difference his shoveling is actually making, other than creating bigger puddles. But he seems satisfied that he's done the job. Then, like a pole vaulter limbering up for a run, he reverses the bus a few metres, sticks it into gear, and goes for it. The engine roars. We approach the massive lake in the middle of the road, and we're free. When we get to the next stop, I future-proof myself against the next leg of this journey and purchase some medication, i.e. a bottle of aguardiente. The one thing that struck me when we were stuck on that bus was that every few minutes a cyclist would cruise past. There we were, in a vehicle with an actual engine, and you had Colombians speeding past on their bikes, as if we weren't high in the mountains or if the surface was made of tarmac. Here's a hot take for you. As a nation, Colombia is good at cycling.
Pacho Rodríguez, campeón. Vargas, Oscar de Jota, campeón. Mosto va por equipo, campeón.
Atención, Colombia, atención.
The new leader of this race is going to be a Colombian. It's not Oran, it is Quintana.
Mucho en la montaña, campeón. Omar Hernández, campeón. Pablo Wittgen, campeón. Carlos Emilio Gutiérrez.
Atención, Colombia, atención. Papito, vamos, Segan. Vamos, Segan.
Campeón de la Vuelta. ¡Qué grande! Campeón de la Vuelta. ¡Qué grande! ¡Qué grande!
Atención, Colombia, atención.
He has opened up the gap. Egan Bernal, the longer this climb is, the better it is for the Colombian.
Ahí va Rigoberto Urán, ¿qué lo va a pasar? ¡Fum! ¡Pasó!
¡Qué joven maravilla! ¡Es la bestia, Egan Bernal!
What a performance by Nairo Quintana, who controls this race, owns it, and indeed everyone else around it.
En este momento, Colombia y Latinoamérica tienen camiseta virtual.
¡Herrera va a ganar la vuelta!
Vamos, Egan, vamos, papito, que ya se termina el puerto. Vamos, vamos.
I'm in Bogotá, Colombia's capital, where for a person who hasn't done any proper cardiovascular exercise in at least 4 months, the altitude makes things like climbing a staircase a bit of a battle. I'm here to meet Matt Rendell. He's a cycling journalist and author of the book Colombia es Pasión. The place we're in is called Moville, a bike store in the Chapinero district of Bogota.
To me, it's a magical little cottage. You'd never find it if you weren't coming here. It's not sort of it's tucked away in a little sort of hamlet.
It is a shrine to the sport of cycling, a museum as much as a shop. Their coffee and fig slices are also 11 out of 10.
My friend Ned Bolting a few years ago came out and he said something that kind of slightly shocked me, and that was we went to Boyacá and we were outside of Combita, where Nairo Quintana's kind of his territory, and looking at the mountains and the road and the 16.5 kilometre climb that Nairo had to climb up every day to get home from school, ride up every day. And he said, you know, how can, you know, it's amazing that someone like Geraint Thomas could compete with kids growing up in these surroundings with all these advantages. And I sort of look at it and think, advantages, really?
Only 7 countries have claimed more Grand Tour general classification wins than Colombia, and they're all European countries. Luis Herrera was a Vuelta de España champion in 1987. Nairo Quintana managed to win the Giro d'Italia as well as the Vuelta. And in 2019, Egan Bernal became the first Latin American GC winner of the Tour de France and the youngest in general since 1909.
I always think in a country like Colombia, which does have a history of violence, it's not surprising somehow that some of these young men have a kind of disposition of the personality that leads them to direct violence inwards. And that's what cycling is. Mm. You know, sustained speed is the product of pain.
Yeah.
That's the equation. That's E equals MC squared in cycling.
Yeah.
You know? So there's altitude, there are good roads, there's this tradition, but it's culture. It's about culture. That's what it's about. Not because there are lots of high places in the world that don't produce champion cyclists.
Yeah.
The place that cycling occupies in the general consciousness of the country doesn't seem that different to other countries. There tends to be a big surge of popularity when one of their own is on track to win a Grand Tour. But the sport doesn't have a universal appeal all year round, certainly when you compare it to something like football.
Cycling in the kind of Colombian psyche is about nation building. Football is kind of the opposite. Football's about tearing the country apart, you know, if it's club sides. I think also football is urban.
Okay.
And it catches the urban edge. You know, whereas cycling, I think, brings a kind of peasant slowness and calmness and patience into the city.
2019 is not that long ago. So for a country like Colombia to have the youngest Tour de France winner in 110 years, you'd be forgiven for thinking that the country is now going through a cycling boom. But this is not the case. And in fact, the opposite is probably true. The reasons why are intertwined with the politics of the country.
What's happened now is that the last elections last year, Egan took a position.
Okay, right.
In favour of one candidate who didn't win.
Okay.
Nairo took a position in favour of another candidate who didn't win. And it's positioned cycling and the Tour Colombia quite awkwardly. There's a kind of background to this because Egan Bernal was born in Zipaquirá, and Zipaquirá has a kind of fringe at the bottom of halfway up a hill that was church land. And in about 1983, a group of freedom fighters called M19, they kind of occupied this land and divided it into parcels and gave it to homeless people. And Egan's parents, who were both the children of peasant farming families, eventually lived in that area. And Egan grew up until he was nine in that area. And the sort of ideological leader of M19, of that guerrilla group, is now Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia.
Mm.
Okay. So Egan, I think, coming out against Petro might have been a little bit of a slap in the face. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if the fact that the Tour Colombia has disappeared off the calendar and the government isn't putting money into that is that we've got slightly got four-year presidential term of a president who's kind of sort of cycling is slightly hostile to my government, so cycling can have its budget, but it ain't getting any more. So there's a little bit of a crisis, and who comes after Egan, I don't know, and no one knows. And so you've just had this amazing golden era of 12, 13 years, and then what happens next?
If cycling's graph is in a complicated place in Colombia, the same can't be said for women's football. It's 6 months before the World Cup in Australia and New Zealand, and I'm sitting down to meet Bogota-based journalist and political scientist Karen Ariza.
I think this World Cup is going to change everything. They are good, but we know it, that they are really good. All the people in Colombia feel like we can change the history of sports with this team, because this team can be a big surprise. And I think we are going to be a surprise. I think maybe semi-finals.
Okay, so Colombia didn't quite end up making the semis in the World Cup. Thanks a million to England for preventing what was so close to being an unbelievable shout from Karen. Colombia before the tournament were 250-1 outsiders, so a quarter-final was a fairly incredible run.
Sometimes the professor is the first person that makes a discrimination of you. You cannot play football. You need to play volleyball because that's a female sport. That's kind of affirmations that we receive all the time. But in this moment, they are not saying that. Why? Because the female football in Colombia is better than male football in this moment. Mm-hmm. Because three qualifications for World Cup, for FIFA, are changing that. Linda Caicedo and Catalina Usme are changing that because they are appearing on TV.
So the expectation in Colombia, as is the case in many countries at this year's World Cup, is that this tournament will be something of a watershed moment for women in sport. And this isn't an unusual feeling for Karen, who has felt the transcendent power of Colombian football in the past.
I'm from 1994, so I was born in a moment, in a delicate moment for my country, when the kidnapping and the bombs and the violence were really, really high. But I was on Brazil 2014, and all Brazilian people just say to me, before the first game for Colombia, they just said, Pablo Escobar and cocaine to me, and I was really sad because I don't want that stigma for me. And after the first game for Colombia, we won 3-0 to Greece. And after that game, all the Brazilian people start to look at me and say, James Rodriguez and Cuadrado are really good players. So it was a big change for me because no one started to me talking like Pablo Escobar and narco stuff. They were talking about Falcao and James, and it happens with Shakira and the music too. But in this moment, we are multiplying the symbols, the good symbols. I have a memory. Sometimes I just see the television and I was hearing about a kidnapping, and I didn't understand the situation. I didn't know what was a kidnapping, but as a kid, I was with that curiosity and I was asking to a lot of people, and some people just explained to me, and I was shocking, like a traumatic situation for me. But I remember when I was seeing that television news about kidnapping, and the next news was about the Pipe Valderrama and Tino Asprilla, and in this moment I have the feeling that I was picking my best moment as a kid to protect myself, to protect my healthy. Pipe Valderrama was so much bigger than a kidnapping. I can't remember what people were related to the kidnapping situation, but the next news was Pipe Valderrama, and I can remember Pipe Valderrama because he's so much better. He's a better symbol of my country than a kidnapping issues.
I'm back in Medellin for one last visit. I've been invited along to a mixed martial arts gym. On the wall, you've got motivational phrases in English. No excuses. You are not tired. You are uninspired. And most importantly, dogs are welcome. I'm here to chat to Juan José Trujillo Riaga, a professional MMA fighter.
I always was the little kid that didn't like, was always scared of getting in a fight because I was always super skinny, super small. When I was starting with it, I started with Taekwondo. I didn't know that didn't work, but don't tell anyone that didn't work. There's a lot of Colombian fighters, but in the highest level of the sports, we can see right now that the guys that say, oh yes, we're from Colombia or whatever, they was born in the US and they have one dad or their moms are from Colombia, but they are not really from here. So we have fighters that have fought in the UFC. Alex El Rolo Torres, is one, I train with him. Freddy Serrano, I train with him also. They fought in the UFC, but we are yet to break that ceiling, right?
What is your dream?
My dream? Well, my dream has always been, since I started this, being the best in the world. But not selfishly, because I'll be honest, when I win, the best feeling in the world. Like, I don't really count the wins as my happiest days in the world. I hate losing. That I can say. I hate losing, and I love winning. But what it truly makes me happy is the effect that a win in the biggest stage and being one of the best and be a world champion can give to my country, can give to my people. That if I'm a world champion, I know the eyeballs are gonna come here. So I say right now, I'm gonna be a world champion, and that's a fact.
Really, I know nothing about Colombia. But listening to young Colombian people like Juan in this MMA gym and Karen in Bogota, I am going to go ahead and make the statement that there's a boundless potential in this country on so many different levels. This is probably the main reason why there's such a frustration with people from Europe or people from North America who come here and just want to talk about Escobar or the drugs trade with every local that they meet. It's pretty clear that they believe they are beyond this point, and rightly so. And besides, Narcos is almost a decade old at this stage. Surely we have moved on to something else by now.
We didn't have anything easy in our life. Like me, I'm 24 years old, I'm young still. So I haven't gone to the worst era of my country. There was the Pablo Escobar era and stuff. But I think we all have those scars. We are always recognized as this drug lord country, or we are Colombia, the country of drugs, of prostitutes. So the heart goes more to that hard work, like hardship that we have gone through in our lifetime. Plus, we don't have anything easy. We literally have to work for everything we have, money, food, everything we have to work hard. And we don't know what easy it is.
Without saying it in so many words, people are pretty grateful that you've not kind of watched Narcos on Netflix and said, right, well, that's Colombia for me then. Yeah. You know, you've gone a bit further.
We have that mark as Narcos and, yeah, cocaine, drugs and violence. And we don't want that anymore. So sports are totally the opposite. Mm-hmm. Until we did finally have an idol, finally we'd have a Falcao, for example, a good person that actually is playing football and learning another languages and be a good person for all the world, and not as a Pablo Escobar thing or a narco stuff.
In general, talking about Pablo Escobar is something that you should be careful with, but you shouldn't completely avoid. You know, it's history. Mm. It's like, I would say, in terms of your attitude, it's like going to Germany and talking about Hitler. You know what I mean? Like, Germans are obviously very, very aware of that part of their history. It's a difficult, it's a painful part of their history. It reflects poorly on the country on one side. It reflects a tragedy on the other side, you know. And I think that similar mentality is appropriate for Pablo Escobar. Now, look, I'm not saying Pablo Escobar is Hitler. He did good things, he did bad things. But a lot of people have died and suffered. And the turbulence and the violence and the way the drugs trade has developed in Colombia is a result of his personality, his decisions.
We are such a good country. Like you can see how beautiful it is, and it's not just the landscape. It's how people behave here. Like everything is getting better. So that's the thing that from my perspective, the perspective I want to show the people is everything is getting better. I don't want to mess with political stuff. I don't care about that, honestly. So I care about myself and how my people can get better. So I think right now we're in an era where we're growing.
This has been episode 1 of Diverted, a 10-part original series for Off the Ball, written and produced by me, Owen Shahan. Clicking follow or subscribe wherever you're consuming this content would mean a lot, as would a positive rating or review, if you were a fan of this sort of thing. My handle across social media platforms is my name, as all one word, and there is video content across those platforms to accompany this podcast. All of that information is in the podcast notes. A word of thanks to Dr. Pete Watson of the University of Leeds not only for chatting to me for this podcast, but also for the help in introducing me to contacts throughout Colombia and South America in general. And thanks also to my great travelling friends, Stan and Libby, who made the introduction to Dr. Watson, to whom Stan is related. It's one of the many, many chance encounters that eventually led to the conversations you'll hear throughout this series. Thanks also to my good friend Jason O'Hearn for some of the original music you would have heard in this episode. Next week on Diverted, we will travel to Chile and tell you about the Scottish man who became an icon of Chilean rugby, the Croat who became an icon of Chilean football, and the Palestinian community who influenced the direction of one of the country's major clubs. Also, part two of my Patagonian hitchhiking journey, where I meet my first real moment of trouble. Chat to you then. Thanks a million for listening.